I want to begin the message today by sharing some statistics with you. So just a few years ago, the American Diabetes Association published a study that contained some interesting data. There's a lot more data than I'm going to share with you this afternoon, but there's a lot of information in that publication. As I said, it was a few years ago, 2021. According to this particular study, there are over 38 million American citizens who've been diagnosed with diabetes. That accounts for about 11% of our population. 11% of the American population has diabetes. There are certain costs associated with that. Our nation spends a lot of money dealing with the treatment of diabetes. In fact, this study actually provided a dollar amount to that, $412 billion. $412 billion is the financial cost associated with the treatment of and diagnosis of diabetes. Here's something else for you to consider. On the CDC website, there's a statistics related to the obesity rate in our country. They've got a chart that breaks it down into four different categories: underweight, healthy weight, overweight, and obese. I'm not going to go into all those details on how they calculate that. I'll simply share one figure from that study: 41.9%. That's the percentage of our population that's classified as being obese. 41.9%. Of course, we understand the health issues related to that condition, but to put it in terms of a dollar amount, they claim the financial cost of our country associated with the treatment of that obesity is $173 billion. Now, this is annually. So according to the data from those studies, $412 billion is spent annually to cover diabetes, and $173 billion is covering obesity. I thought those were eye-opening, shocking numbers when I read that. Two very serious health conditions that many of our people in this nation suffer. But that's not the topic of the sermon today. I want to talk about another condition that's becoming prevalent as the years move along, and that condition is loneliness. Loneliness is certainly much more difficult to quantify. There are many official polls that are published online, many polls about facts and figures related to loneliness, but you don't treat loneliness in the same way that you treat diabetes or obesity, so it's much more difficult to quantify the raw numbers. Really seems to depend on the study that you want to reference. Some studies claim that the number is as low as 30%, while others claim that it's as high as 60%. 60%. It's a much higher number than those first two conditions that I've shared with you today. Potentially, up to 60% of our population deals with loneliness. Really don't think you need an exact number to realize just how significant that really is. Besides that, how do you financially quantify the impact of loneliness? That would be very difficult to do, I'm quite sure. But the point is, loneliness has become an epidemic in our nation. And you see signs of it even beyond the recent COVID years, where we were much more isolated from one another than we are right now. People are lonely. It's a real problem. As we get into this, I want to distinguish two separate things here. We're not talking about being alone. We're talking about feeling lonely. Being alone is not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, if you look at the life of Jesus Christ, intentionally choosing to be alone can sometimes be quite productive. Before his public ministry began, you remember the story. He was baptized by John the Baptist, and he's led into the wilderness by the Holy Spirit. 40 days in the wilderness, alone. Now, I know he was being ministered. He was ministered by the angels, but when you talk about human interaction, he was alone. As you read through the full account, I think you can see how that experience was preparing him for that public ministry. Let's go to Matthew 14. I just mentioned John the Baptist. He prepared the way for Jesus Christ, a living fulfillment of a prophecy back in Malachi. John baptized Christ, and then he directed the people's attentions towards Jesus Christ. Matthew 14, it describes the end of his life, speaking of John the Baptist. I want to pick it up in verse 1. Matthew 14, verse 1. At that time, Herod the Tetrarch heard the report about Jesus and said to his servants, "This is John the Baptist. He's risen from the dead, and therefore these powers are at work in him." For Herod had laid hold of John and bound him and put him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife. Verse 4, here's the reason why. Because John had said to him, "It's not lawful for you to have her." You know, that sentence opens up a small window into the example of John the Baptist. You know, he was not afraid to speak the truth. Verse 5, and although he wanted to put him to death, he feared the multitude because they counted him as a prophet. But when Herod's birthday was celebrated, the daughter of Herodias danced before them and pleased Herod. Therefore, he promised with an oath to give her whatever she might ask. So she, having been prompted by her mother, said, "Give me John the Baptist's head here on a platter." And the king was sorry. Nevertheless, because of the oaths and because of those who sat with him, he commanded it to be given to her. So he sent and had John beheaded in prison. And his head was brought on a platter and given to the girl. She brought it up to her mother. Verse 12, then his disciples came and took away the body and buried it and went and told Jesus. When Jesus heard it, he departed from there by boat to a deserted place by himself. So he was alone. Jesus was processing this moment of grief, alone, by himself. Again, it's an illustration of how being alone can be productive. He was grieving the death of John the Baptist. And that would have been a gruesome death. We just read about that. Absolutely gruesome. But Christ chose to be alone in that moment. Luke chapter 5. Let's go there next, if you would. Luke chapter 5. Just going to read one verse, but it's further evidence of Christ spending time alone, intentionally choosing for himself to be alone. Luke chapter 5. Verse 16. Luke 5, 16. So he himself, this is Jesus Christ, he himself often withdrew into the wilderness and prayed. There are many examples of Christ spending solitary time alone, praying to God the Father. And that was time well spent. It was productive time. Let's go to Luke chapter 6. Luke chapter 6 is an example of him doing this very thing, withdrawing himself to pray. Luke 6, verse 12. Now it came to pass in those days that he went out to the mountain to pray and continued all night in prayer to God. So here we have Christ praying all by himself all night long. Verse 13. And when it was day, he called his disciples to himself, and from them he chose 12, whom he also named apostles. So before he chose those 12 apostles, we see here that Christ prayed about that. Before he made this very important decision, he withdrew himself from everybody else, took some time alone, and he talked about that decision with God. I don't want to spend all our time making this point because there are many different places we could turn to, but in those moments that we've just read about, Jesus Christ did not feel lonely. He was simply being alone. So there's a difference. And there were benefits to those private moments of being alone. He took time to privately grieve. He went off by himself before making a major decision. He went off by himself before taking on a major project, like preaching his public ministry. Even in other places in the Bible, you see where Christ took a break, where he had been working hard after periods of long, hard work. he took a break to recharge the batteries, you might say. When he was distressed, you think about the Garden of Gethsemane, he stepped away privately to compose his thoughts and to communicate with God the Father. And he was certainly distressed in that moment, right? Remember, he fervently prayed to the point where it looked like he was sweating drops of blood. Most certainly because he knew what was coming. But you know, if possible, take this cup from me, yet not my will, but yours. He was communicating with God, accepting the will of God through that process of prayer. Not every prayer that Christ gave, though, was during moments of being completely alone. That's also important. He wasn't always completely alone. When he kept the Passover with his disciples, when he prayed the true Lord's Prayer, you can read about that in John 17. That was in the presence of his disciples. But I do think that's very clear that he spent quality, productive time alone. Perhaps you've heard of the Myers-Briggs personality test. I actually think it's very interesting to learn more about our personalities. And it's not just interesting, it's also very helpful, as well as learning the personalities of other people, not just our own, but other people. As you begin to understand other people, that helps you better communicate with them. So it definitely helps to learn more about other people's personalities. Two main factors of the Myers-Briggs test are extrovert and introvert. Extroverts get their energy from being around other people. They feed off of that, while introverts are able to recharge by withdrawing themselves. We have a good mix of that within the Ellis household. We have some extroverts and some introverts. But you know, introverts just need a little more time to by themselves to re-energize themselves. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with needing or wanting to be alone from time to time. You see the life of Christ, and there are numerous examples of how important those moments of solitude are. And those moments of solitude, it's not about our personality. You know, that's important whether you're an extrovert or an introvert. But introverted personalities just need a little bit more time alone. And that's okay, it's just part of the wiring. By this point, what I hope to be getting across to you is that there's a difference between being feeling lonely and being alone. Being alone is completely different. It's valuable. It does have a purpose, but it's not the same thing as feeling lonely. I thought it might be helpful to look at some biblical characters who had brief moments of feeling lonely. They just felt lonely. And the situations were conducive to these particular individuals feeling lonely. 1 Kings 19. 1 Kings 19, we'll look at one brief moment in the life of Elijah. 1 Kings 19. He's coming off of a powerful victory at Mount Carmel. You know, the prophets of Baal had their altar, and Elijah had his altar. I'm sure you'll remember the story, fire coming down from heaven and consuming Elijah's offering. You know, basically, there's no competition. Elijah's God, our God, won that contest, plain and simple. Furthermore, those false prophets were destroyed. Chapter 19 is picking things up right after that miraculous event. 1 Kings 19, starting in verse 1. And Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done. Also how he had executed all the prophets with the sword. Jezebel was not very pleased with this news. That's a bit of an understatement. Verse 2, then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So let the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time." Talking about the false prophets that had been killed. And when she saw that, he arose and ran for his life and went to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and he left his servant there. So he leaves his servant there in Beersheba, but that wasn't far enough away for Elijah, not for his comfort, so he keeps running. Verse 4, But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree. And he prayed that he might die and said, "It's enough. Now, Lord, take my life, for I'm no better than my father's." Then as he lay and slept under a broom tree, suddenly an angel touched him and said to him, "Arise and eat." Verse 6, then he looked, and there by his head was a cake baked on coals and a jar of water. So he ate and drank and lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came back the second time and touched him and said, "Arise and eat, because the journey's too great for you." So he arose, ate and drank, and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights as far as Horeb, the mountain of God. So at this point, Elijah's withdrawing even further away. Verse 9, and there he went into a cave and spent the night in that place. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" So he said, I've been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life." It can be very easy to read this and be overly critical of Elijah. I've done that myself. I mean, come on, Elijah. God literally wiped out the prophets of Baal right in front of you, before your very own eyes. What could you possibly be scared of? We may sometimes underestimate the powerfully evil influence of Jezebel. She was really something. Just imagine how far away Elijah's withdrawing himself. It's not to draw close to God, though. It's not like what we saw with Jesus. No, Elijah's running for his life. He's frightened. He feels lonely. We see that in verse 10. "I alone am left, and they seek to take my life." Probably mentioned this before, but you'll hear me talk about this quite often. I just love God's amazing level of patience. He's patient with every one of us, and he's patient with Elijah here. He's patient and gracious, redirecting his attention. Drop down to verse 18. This is the Lord speaking to Elijah. Verse 18, "Yet I've reserved 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed down to Baal, and every mouth has not kissed him." Essentially, what he's telling Elijah here is, you may feel like you're completely by yourself, but you're not. There are others committed to me. And this conversation does redirect Elijah. If you continue on with the account, it's just a moment of his life, a brief moment of loneliness. But he does overcome that. He got back to the work that God had for him, that he was called to do. He refocused his attention. I truly believe that helped Elijah in so many ways. Not just realizing that there were other people walking this same walk, but also having a purpose. Elijah had a purpose. He went on and anointed Jehu king over Israel, and he began to establish a relationship with Elisha as well. It gave him purpose along with a sense of community. Let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. There were others who faced moments like Elijah did, where they were lonely, where the environment was conducive to those feelings of loneliness. Think about King David running for his life as his son Absalom's chasing after him, trying to kill him. I can only imagine what that must have felt like from the perspective of King David. We get a small glimpse into his mindset. In Psalm 25, it talks about how he felt desolate and afflicted. So in other words, David felt lonely. Or what about Moses fleeing Egypt, wandering around the wilderness, a life of exile, very different than anything he would have experienced in his life before that time. He described himself as a stranger in a strange land. In both of those cases, though, with David and with Moses, God was able to redirect their attention towards some mighty works that he was doing through their lives. They had a purpose, and they were not alone. So they didn't remain in that state of mind, in that state of loneliness. They were just brief moments in time. The reason why I'm bringing all of this up is because if they could fall into those moments, then so can we. You and I are human beings just like they were. Let's go to Genesis 21. Genesis chapter 21, another example to consider. Genesis 21, Elijah had left his servant in Beersheba, traveled off into the wilderness alone. Moses, as he left Egypt, he was alone. David was alone. It's very easy to feel alone when you are alone, but it doesn't have to be that way. This next person in Genesis 21, she wasn't alone. She had a companion, but she definitely felt lonely. Genesis 21, verse 9. Here we have Abraham caught between the grips of two different women, Sarah, the mother of Isaac, and Hagar, the mother of Ishmael. Sarah wants this woman gone. Get rid of this maid. Get rid of her child. Genesis 21, verse 9. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom she bore to Abraham, scoffing. Therefore she said to Abraham, "Cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, namely with Isaac." And the matter was very displeasing in Abraham's sight because of his son. But God said to Abraham, "Do not let it be displeasing in your sight because of the lad or because of your bondwoman. Whatever Sarah said to you, listen to her voice. For in Isaac your seed shall be called. Yet I'll also make a nation of the son of the bondwoman, because he is your seed." So God promised Abraham here to make a nation from Ishmael because he was his seed. Was Hagar aware of that promise? When you look at her actions, I'm not quite so sure. I'm not sure she is. Verse 14. So Abraham rose early in the morning and took bread and a skin of water, and putting it on her shoulder, he gave it and the boy to Hagar and sent her away. Then she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. She's banished, cast aside. How would that make you feel? I think I'd feel pretty lonely, and she does. Verse 15, and the water in the skin was used up, and she placed the boy under one of the shrubs. Then she went and sat down across from him at a distance of about a bow shot, for she said to herself, "Let me not see the death of the boy." So she sat opposite him and lifted her voice and wept. Again, she's not alone. Hagar's here with her son, but she still feels isolated and lonely. She's in despair because she's convinced this boy's about to die. Did she know what God had promised to Abraham? I don't think she did, not at this point. Verse 17, and God heard the voice of the lad. Then the angel of God called to Hagar out of heaven and said to her, "What ails you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad and hold him with your hand, for I will make him a great nation." There's that promise that was given to Abraham. Now, again, we're going to see how he's redirecting her focus. He's redirecting Hagar's focus, just like those other examples we looked at. Verse 19. Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. And she went and filled the skin with water and gave the lad a drink. So God was with the lad, and he grew and dwelt in the wilderness and became an archer. Verse 21, he dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt. To simply summarize all these accounts that we've looked at, they were moments in time when an individual was facing a very difficult situation and they felt lonely, remote from human habitations and other humans in general, completely isolated from everyone and everything. And with Hagar specifically, that example shows us that human beings can feel that way even when we're in the company of someone else. We can feel lonely even when we're not completely alone. But in each case, God was able to redirect their attention. So that's the point that I'm making. These were temporary moments of loneliness. It was not a permanent condition. So we see examples like these throughout the Bible, and they can help us relate to that condition just a little bit, to recognize that loneliness is something that potentially every one of us can face. I mean, you're talking about powerful individuals here. Moses, David, Elijah, those men had strength. If it was a hazard for them, then it could potentially become a hazard for any one of us, especially when you consider the statistics of the nation that we live in. Somewhere between 30 and 60% of our nation's population faces this battle, that struggle with feeling lonely. We live in this society, therefore it's logical to assume that we could also be faced with the same thing in our own lives. The potential's there anyway. Have you ever felt lonely? Even for the briefest moment in time, have you ever felt lonely? Some of us are single. Some of us are married. Some of us are an only child. Some of us have a lot of siblings. Regardless of any of those details, the epidemic is growing in society, the epidemic of loneliness. So it's important to recognize that it exists and to be cognizant of ways to combat that, to combat those feelings of loneliness. Some may think, so what if people get lonely sometimes? What's the big deal with that? Why is that something that needs to be combated against anyway? In preparing for this message, I came across a number of different resources that claim loneliness is a precursor to depression. In other words, extended exposure to long periods of loneliness, there's a potential there of those feelings becoming more permanent, again, leading to depression. I'm not a doctor, okay? I'm simply sharing some of the information that I came across. The more exposure you have to those feelings of loneliness, the harder it's going to become to pull yourself out of that. Some people who have dealt with depression know exactly what Elijah was talking about as he sat down there under the broom tree. I'm not saying that Elijah was depressed, but what I'm saying is that we want to avoid as much as we can that sentiment of, you know, just take my life. It'd be a whole lot better than dealing with this situation that I'm in. Thankfully, God was able to redirect Elijah's focus, because in that moment, in that mindset, you're not going to be productive in the work that God's called you to be a part of. So it's a serious thing to think about. The epidemic of loneliness should not be brushed off and ignored. That would be a mistake. If you go to Amazon.com and type in that search criteria, you know, air quotes here, loneliness epidemic, you'll be presented with 97 different books, all addressing this very serious condition of loneliness. And I'm sure that some of those books are very helpful, but what I want to focus on for the remainder of the message today is to see what the Bible has to say about this. The Bible, of course, that's the most important book that's ever been written. What does the Bible say? How do we combat loneliness? How does the Bible answer that very important question? How do we combat loneliness? Let's go to Ecclesiastes chapter 4. Ecclesiastes 4. Words from the wisest man who's ever lived, King Solomon. Through the inspiration of God, what does he have to say about loneliness? What's the biblical solution to this epidemic of loneliness? Ecclesiastes chapter 4, starting with verse 8. Ecclesiastes 4, verse 8. There's one alone, without companion. Literally, the word means without a second. It's just one alone. He's neither son nor brother, yet there's no end to all his labors, nor is his eye satisfied with riches. But he never asks, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? This also is vanity and a grave misfortune. This reminds me of what God says back in Genesis when he created Adam. He said, it's not good that man should be alone. I'll make a helper comparable to him. Of course, that was commenting on the relationship between a husband and a wife, but it's really the same basic principle here in this passage. Introvert, extrovert, whatever your personality is, it's not good that man or woman should be alone, because that tends to lead to isolation and loneliness. We're not designed that way. That's the context here in the book of Ecclesiastes. How do you combat loneliness? It's about community. There are clear benefits to having companionship. It's mentioned in the following verses, continuing on with verse 9. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. Again, if two lie down together, they'll keep warm, but how can one be warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord's not quickly broken. This passage comments on the principle of being there for one another. One very important community that can help us prevent and overcome those moments of loneliness is our family. Our family can help us to overcome loneliness. Last week we discussed Deuteronomy chapter 6, the value of those parents involved in the lives of their children. It's incredibly valuable to have those parents frequently and consistently directing their children towards a relationship with God. And by doing that, you're also developing healthy relationships within the family structure. You're spending a lot of productive time together, rubbing shoulders with one another while discussing God's way of life. So that's very important for the parents to be involved with the children. It's a biblical principle. Again, we talked about that last week as we read through Deuteronomy. Even as those children grow up, maybe they're not in the house anymore. At that point, the relationship does change a little bit, but it should not be neglected. What about the children's point of view, though? Although it does say that a man should leave his father and mother and be joined with his wife, that does not mean that they completely forsake any relationship with their father or their mother, no longer having anything to do with them. I don't think that's correct at all. As we talk about preventing and overcoming loneliness, the family is one tool that can be used. Family relationships can be used to combat loneliness. It's this concept of two being better than one. Just read that in Ecclesiastes. Children do have a responsibility for their parents. Let's go to 1 Timothy chapter 5. 1 Timothy 5. I'm going to take a moment to look at this from the perspective of children. First Timothy 5, starting in the first verse, verse 1. 1 Timothy 5, verse 1. Do not rebuke an older man, but exhort him as a father. Younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, younger women as sisters, with all purity. Honor widows who are really widows, but if any widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show piety at home and to repay their parents. For this is good and acceptable before God. Verse 5. Now she who's really a widow and left alone trusts in God and continues in supplications and prayers night and day. But she who lives in pleasure is dead while she lives. And these things command that they may be blameless. But if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he's denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. When you're reading through the Bible, context is very important. And the specific context of this passage is about financial responsibilities of the children, what they have, the responsibility they have towards their parents. It's talking about the widows. If the widow's children have the financial means to take care of her, then they should do so. Shouldn't be left for the church to do that. There seems to be an indication that here within this chapter that had become somewhat of a problem within the church, where widows were claiming support from the church without first seeking help from their children who had means to do so. And again, that is the context, providing financial support to our parents. As children, that's our obligation if we're able to do so. But you can also look at this principle from a much broader perspective, not just monetarily. What about the time and energy that children can also provide to the parents? There's something to that. How do you combat loneliness? Two are better than one. Spend time with one another. There's mutual benefits in doing so. In the very busy world that we live in, we may need to get creative with that sometimes. Distance can become a real issue. We don't always live in the same place as our families. That's the situation I find myself in. But it shouldn't prevent us from having good relationships with our parents or communicating with them. Something as simple as an occasional phone call, just checking in, really could make all the difference. Look back up in verse 4. Look at verse 4 again. Reading from the New King James translation says, children or grandchildren. If a widow has children or grandchildren. Now, if you're reading from a King James Bible, that doesn't say grandchildren. The King James Version says nephews. If you look into that Greek word, it's Strong's number 1549 and could be translated as broadly as descendants. So it doesn't necessarily have to mean grandchildren. There's not a limitation there. The point is, we're talking about family. But you can expand that beyond simply talking about the nuclear family where you have two parents and the children. You know, include nieces, nephews, aunts, uncles, cousins. You see my point. It's not limited to just children and their parents. It's family relationships in general. There's value to those relationships, and we should maintain them as much as possible. If we can keep those relationships healthy, then we're better equipped to ward off those feelings of loneliness. Let's go to Matthew chapter 12. Continuing with this thought, the value of family relationships, Matthew 12, family relationships warding off those feelings of loneliness. Here in Matthew 12, Christ amplifies what our family looks like. Matthew 12, picking it up in verse 46. Matthew 12, 46. While he was still talking to the multitudes, behold, his mother and brother stood outside, seeking to speak with him. Then one said to him, look, your mother and your brothers are standing outside, seeking to speak with you. But he answered and said to the one who told him, who is my mother, and who are my brothers? And he stretched out his hand towards his disciples and said, here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother. There's a family relationship between those who have chosen to follow God's way of life. Every one of us here today, we may not have the aspect of being direct descendants of one another, but we are considered to be a family. The Apostle Paul builds on this concept over in Galatians chapter 6. If you'll go there with me. Galatians 6, we'll read verse 10. We just read the words of Christ where he said, those who do the will of my Father are my family. They're my brother, my sister, my mother. I want to read what Paul says as well. Galatians 6, verse 10. Galatians 6, 10. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith. The household of faith. In other words, the family of faith. We truly are a family, and we have a responsibility towards one another. Of course, we do good to all as we have opportunity, but it says especially to those who are in your family, the household of faith. Just like with your physical family, when you were born, you did not choose who your parents were going to be. You did not choose your siblings, your cousins, none of that. We see the same thing within the Church of God. Appreciated Mr. Gabriel sharing some of his background. I love hearing where we all come from because we all are. We're part of a family. God does the calling. We don't choose for ourselves. Now, we have to answer that calling. But we don't choose for ourselves independently from God. I think we understand that. Within our family, right now, talking about within the Church of God, the household of faith, what can we do? Within our family, what are some things that we can do? How can we do good to one another in a way that helps us prevent or overcome those feelings of loneliness, those brief moments of loneliness? What can we do? Two are better than one. But what are some ways that we can look out for one another in this area? Certainly don't want anybody within our spiritual family having those feelings of loneliness. Now, again, I began today by pointing out the differences between being alone and feeling lonely. Those are two very different things. If someone's wanting to be alone, we should definitely respect that. But we don't want someone feeling lonely. I don't bring this up to somehow imply that our congregation's not doing this. That's not my purpose at all. Just consider it a reminder and an encouragement to continue doing what you're doing. But since loneliness continues to be a challenge for society around us, it's important to be aware of this issue, to be prepared for it. As a congregation, I think we do a good job of this. There are opportunities of fellowship each Sabbath. In fact, next week, as we've already mentioned, we have an opportunity for potluck. Potlucks are a wonderful example of fellowship, opportunities for fellowship, chance to get to know one another and spend quality time together with our family. But beyond that, more specifically, what can we do to combat loneliness? For our next Bible verse, let's go to Philippians chapter 2. Philippians chapter 2, and we'll read verse 4. Philippians 2, verse 4. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also the interests of others. That's something that we should be looking for, ways to look out for our brethren, our family members. The problem exists. It's a problem in society, the loneliness epidemic. So we should be looking out for one another. Perhaps it may be helpful for me to share an example of what this looks like within the church. I know of an individual within the church, and they've given me permission to share this story with you today. I won't mention their name, but it is a church member, someone who was dealing with moments of discouragement and loneliness. That loneliness eventually evolved into depression. No longer brief moments of loneliness, but continual feelings of depression. Even though they were surrounded by others, they still struggled with this, like Elijah or Hagar sitting out there in the wilderness, a very difficult mental state. As others in this situation have said, they could not explain why they felt the way that they did. They just felt that way. Even though they had other people around them, it was still that struggle that they had to overcome. What happened with this particular individual was another church member became a prominent influence within their life. Daily, they reached out daily to this person. Text messages, phone calls, just daily check-ins with this person. They had recognized that something was different, something was wrong, and they just became this steady, consistent influence, choosing to bear that burden with their brethren, their fellow family member within the household of faith. And what that does is it tells that person, I'm right here with you, and I will always be right here with you. There's patience involved with that. It's a struggle. You know, this may seem easy for me to stand up here and talk about, but it's not always easy to implement this into action. It's not easy to admit that you've become lonely. It's not always easy to recognize when someone else is lonely. I understand that, I do. But it comes back to this attitude of looking out for the interests of others and being observant about what's going on around us. It's that idea of two being better than one. Because when one falls, when we recognize that our brother or sister may be dealing with something, we can step in and we can help them get back up. And again, these are just reminders for us all. There's more to discuss, though. We're to be there for our family, our spiritual family as well, the household of faith. That's one way that we can combat loneliness. But there's one more area that I want to mention this afternoon. That's our relationship with God. Our relationship with God. I want to turn to a couple of very comforting verses within the book of Isaiah. If you'll turn there with me to Isaiah 41, pick it up in verse 10. Isaiah 41, verse 10. No matter what we're going through in life, God promises to be there with us. But I love the way he describes that relationship here in Isaiah 41. Again, I want to read this through the context of overcoming loneliness. Isaiah 41, verse 10. Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Yes, I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. Two are better than one. If one falls, the other will help him up. God is there for us. He will always be there to uphold us with his righteous right hand. Drop down to verse 13. For I, the Lord your God, will hold your right hand, saying to you, fear not, I will help you. I will help you get back up. I will help you redirect your attention to focus on looking beyond this present brief moment of loneliness, to help you see that you're not alone. I'm here with you. That's an amazing encouragement that God gives to us. I try to visualize that in my mind with the limited human comprehension that I have, but I just picture this as a small child sitting over by themselves, dealing with a brief moment of being upset, and along comes the Father. First, he notices the child, he notices the situation, then he sits down next to the child and simply holds their hand and tells them, it's going to be okay. Or maybe the father doesn't say anything at all. Maybe it's just his presence alone holding that child's hand, providing that source of comfort. It's an incredible source of comfort. Fear not. I'm here for you. I will help you in any way that I can. I will hold your right hand. You know, we read these words and it's comforting. But there's science behind this as well. A psychology professor at the University of Virginia, he has some very interesting findings with his research. The man's name is James Cohn, and he apparently has researched why people hold hands. Here's a quote from his publication. People hold hands for many reasons, but if there's a single common denominator unifying them all, it's probably a felt sense of security, a sense that we are not alone. It brings with it the knowledge that we have a companion, a helper, a guide, another mind who knows about and is interested in ours. Goes on to say, quote, we found, for example, that holding hands can reduce activity in a part of the brain called the hypothalamus, which is responsible for regulating part of the body's stress response. Something as simple as just holding hands can have a powerful impact on the human brain. It's amazing, and it's just so fitting with what's described here in Isaiah. God says he'll hold our hand. And by making that declaration, he's telling us that we are not alone. It's truly a source of comfort. And it literally triggers something in our brains. We need that encouragement. We need that relationship with God where he promises to help us overcome so many things. You can talk about overcoming sin, working through the death of a friend or a family member, personal health trials, problems at work or school. In all those things, God's there for us and will help us. But it also applies to our resistance to this societal epidemic, the loneliness epidemic. It's out there in the world. But God can provide to us a source of strength and comfort. Our relationship with him can help us combat that influence of loneliness. We can take advantage of those benefits by maintaining a healthy relationship with him. Talk to him. Reach out to him. Share with him what you're going through. He wants to be involved in our lives. Fear not, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. It's truly a wonderful statement. As time moves along, we'll continue to face problems and challenges, including the very serious threat of society's loneliness epidemic. It's difficult to quantify just how prevalent it's become, but some claim that it's up to 60% of the entire population struggling with loneliness. So it's a real problem. And if it's a problem in the world, then we're going to at least be exposed to it in our own lives. The potential problem exists within the church. So we're left with asking ourselves the question, what do we do about that? The Bible provides us with the answer. It's a simple principle that has a powerful impact. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who's alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. That should not describe any one of us here in this room today, having no one to help us up. No, we have access to a number of relationships that can help us as we address this concerning threat of loneliness. Our physical family, children, parents, grandparents, our spiritual family, the household of faith, brethren, committed to stepping in and helping one another as we see the needs arise. But most importantly, our relationship with God. He grabs us by the hand and promises that he's going to be there for us. Fear not, for I am with you. These three things are very good resources to tap into as we consider ways that we can combat the epidemic of loneliness.